Welcome to today's AHRQ webcast, the National Web-Based Teleconference on Health IT and Underserved Populations, Health IT Adoption in Rural Clinical Settings. I'd like to introduce today's moderator, Angela Lavanderos, who's a management analyst with the Health IT Portfolio with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. Angela, the floor is all yours.
Thank you, Colin. Good morning, and on behalf of AHRQ, I'd like to thank you for joining today's national teleconference. I'd like to briefly introduce our three presenters today. We have Dr. Maggie Gunter, President and Executive Director of Loveless Clinic Foundation Research, Dr. Paul Gorman, Associate Professor in the Department of Medical Informatics and Clinical Epidemiology at Oregon Health Sciences University, and Mr. John Kravitz, Assistant Vice President of Information Technology at Geisinger Health System located in Danville, Pennsylvania. We will begin with Dr. Gunter, who will begin this teleconference by discussing the challenges of establishing a health information exchange in a rural area. She will also speak about efforts to use telemedicine to improve health care in New Mexico. Dr. Gunter, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Angela. I am really pleased to be here and talking about one of our favorite topics here, and that's the adventures we've had in health information exchange building and coordinating with other HIT initiatives in New Mexico. Wanted to show you just a sense of what we call the land of enchantment. And some of you know that the famous Route 66 goes through our state, a very rural state. You can see up the upper left corner our distinctive architecture, Pueblo type. You see in the middle there our famous roadrunner bird of famous cartoon fame, and over on the bottom left, you see a very famous thing that you should all come and visit sometime, and that's our balloon fiesta. That's quite an amazing thing of about 750 balloons every during the first week of October. On the far bottom right, you can see that if you look at that, it doesn't exactly look like Pennsylvania or New York. New Mexico's map shows that we are really a very rural state, and that's one of our characteristics you also see in the bottom center, our Carlsbad Caverns. So come and visit sometimes, but all of these things are very relevant to the issue of developing health information technology and implementing it in our very, very rural state. Sometimes rural doesn't quite capture it. We're more frontier. So we're going to talk briefly again about the demographics of New Mexico, who is our organization, LCF Research, because we're leading a number of those initiatives and the evolution of one of those major initiatives, which is the New Mexico Health Information Collaborative, which we call NIMHIC. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the rural pilots that we've done, because although we're a rural state in general, we certainly have even more rural areas than Albuquerque, which is the one main metropolitan area. We're going to talk also about the importance in a rural area of coordinating with other HIT initiatives, and that includes telehealth and Project ECHO, which we'll tell you a little bit more about. One of the things that a number of us know are the barriers and facilitators, and there are some facilitators for HIT in a rural state, and some of the lessons learned. So, again, very much predominantly rural. You know, when somebody says Cape Cod is rural, it's a very different kind of rural than we are here in New Mexico. Pretty much the only metropolitan area is the Albuquerque four-county metropolitan statistical area, and it has the majority, probably 800,000 or 900,000 of the state's 2 million population. Just to say how rural, there are only two other cities in this very large, geographically large state that have 50,000 or more people, and that's Santa Fe, that's quite famous, as you know, and Las Cruces. So we really have basically one metro area and one health sciences center at the University of New Mexico, just to give you a little sense of what it is like here. The other thing is, when there are lists of some things that one doesn't want, we are right at the top, and that is that we're one of the right up there with Mississippi in terms of a very high poverty population, very high Medicaid. 50% or more of New Mexico's children are on Medicaid. And probably the second highest uninsured rate among the U.S. states. But interestingly, one of the things that's been helpful is we have a history of innovation in healthcare. We were, Dr. Lovelace was good friends with Dr. Mayo and established one of the first group practices in the Southwest, including a lot of research and innovation long before there was even a University of New Mexico medical school. So it's got an interesting, you know, we're all hearing about integrated systems as models for healthcare reform. And frankly, there are three major integrated systems that dominate the Albuquerque market. And that has made a sense, a difference in terms of leadership. This just, again, gives you a little sense. You see Albuquerque there in about the middle with a little north of center. And this slide actually comes from our regional extension center work, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. It just shows that out of a 2 million population, you know, we really have only about 3 million primary care physicians in all of New Mexico. So it's a very different kind of population to manage in terms of healthcare resources. We certainly have problems with distribution of healthcare resources and workforce issues of attracting, you know, physicians and other healthcare providers to the state. Well, so who are we, and what are we doing with all of this? We're originally called Lovelace Clinic Foundation. We now have changed our name to LCF Research, or changed it as a doing business as, because we are now doing so many more things and statewide things that are beyond our very important early relationship with the Lovelace Health System. We are a nonprofit, Applied Health Research and Medical Education Institute, and now we are very involved since about 2004 with health information technology. Again, we were created by the Integrated Lovelace Health System to foster involvement of the medical group in healthcare delivery research and medical education, and we still are very involved in that, and now we do much more of that in a broader context. One of the adventures we had, it's been kind of fun to be in the vanguard, along with folks like Geisinger that you'll hear from and many others, in the area of provider-based disease management and translational research. And it's exciting to us that we hear so much more about that work is still central to what's going on today and still relevant. So we've always been very much researchers, but also very much about innovation. So we were not just the folks that evaluated things. We were about designing, developing, implementing, and evaluating. And the recent name change that we've had to LCF Research is to really reflect our broader, more neutral statewide leadership role, because now we really work with a variety of organizations, including folks like Presbyterian that are actually in competition with Lovelace. So we really needed to have a more neutral name to reflect that. How did we get involved in the area of health information exchange? And it's interesting, Dr. David Blumenthal, of the head of the Office of National Coordinator, said it's really interesting to me, he's a health services researcher, that a health services research organization is leading this effort. And the reason is we actually asked our board what we should be doing to improve healthcare in New Mexico. And a really sharp guy from Intel that was a community leader said, well, why, when I go to my physician's office, can't he or she get my information on healthcare utilization from wherever I got care, so I don't have to fill out the same forms again, so that he has more complete information on me and can do a better job? And we thought that really made a lot of sense. So thank goodness for AHRQ and their three-year and five-year grant program in about 2004, which made all the difference in our getting started. And one of the things I thought was very sharp of them is to require a 100% community match for every federal dollar. That meant that you really had to engage the community. And so the idea was, how do we create a health information exchange network that could take all this scattered information currently scattered in many different organizations to provide more complete information at the point of care? There are many other things that are advantages of health information exchange, but that was our first emphasis. And the hope was then that you would have increased care coordination and better quality and more efficiency, and certainly fewer medical errors for that we know are a major issue, and fewer and lower costs. We initially, we're led by a 30-member stakeholder steering committee across the initially more across Albuquerque. Now we are really a large have a large LCF board of directors that's all across the whole state, and we make sure that we have rural representation. It's very important. I grew up in a rural area of Colorado, and I am very aware of how we always felt like Denver called all the shots, and I really think it's so important for rural areas to have a real voice in these important matters. We have been primarily funded by federal with limited state funding. Again, remember, we're not a very wealthy state, and so the federal dollars from both HRQ and from the Office of the National Coordinator have been very critical seed dollars. As we know, we must move, though, to a sustainable business model for the future. We were fortunate enough to be one of the first 9 health information exchanges to receive one of the Nationwide Health Information Network Trial Implementation Awards, which really helped us, again, to have the funding to really pay for the technology and a major vendor that could really had expertise in health information exchange. We were proud that we have really assembled, I think, quite an excellent team over time, and a lot of takes a number of years, but a lot of trust from the community, and we were able to be designated as by the governor or the state designated entity for health information exchange, and that put us in a position to get funding for our state, the entire state, from the Office of the National Coordinator under stimulus funding under the ERA Act. Now, the other really critical thing for the rural areas, I had been concerned for some time that how do we help folks in rural areas that really have a great deal of difficulty paying for an electronic health record and a lot of other things. And I was very pleased that the federal government put together a Health Information Technology Regional Extension Center program. And we also were, sometimes I don't think it's fortunate, but because it's quite a daunting task, but it's exciting to be in the forefront of not only leading the Health Information Exchange, but also the Regional Extension Center, which is really whole task is to provide technical assistance to primary care providers that are in small, 10 and under, and rural practices so that they can implement electronic health records and exchange data and in turn not only improve their practice and their quality and efficiency, but also qualify for important federal meaningful use incentives that some of you know about that are for, you know, for those that are able to comply and use their EHRs to improve care. Now, what's happening now for us, most of, it's taken a number of years, but most of the urban and numerous rural providers do provide data for NMHEC. There are now 13 hospitals, the 2 largest labs in the state that probably provide probably 80% of all of the lab tests in the state, the 2 largest medical groups, and the Department of Health. So we have now in our Master Patient Index, which is, you know, the mechanism for exchanging the data and finding the patients, we have 1,330,000 unique patients, and that's out of only 2 million in our state. So we're coming along that way. We do have a real customer now in the face of the Department of Health, and that is for e-reporting of notifiable conditions and lab results for those, as well as emergency department utilization that is also mandated for our state. We will move into full live production with clinical users, the real holy grail of the Health Information Exchange, in late 2010. So one of the things we wanted to tell you about, since our emphasis here is on rural, is some of our early efforts to establish a rural test site. From the very first, in our AHRQ proposal, we knew it was really critical to both mobilize the single metropolitan area, but we really wanted to have thought it was critical to have a rural pilot site. And Holy Cross Hospital in Taos has been so progressive and an early innovator in a number of things, and really stepped forward to take on this role in 2004, that most of us, you know, that was a really innovative thing to do on their part, and we've always kind of really appreciated their efforts. So they also did some early pilot demonstrations. We did some that had to do with the Master Person Index. That was a really critical issue to find out, to create and test our early Master Patient Index, and that was across, you know, all different kinds of settings, including Taos. But Taos did two specific ones. They said, you know, we've got some of these diabetes disease management programs that kind of go across the community, from the hospital to the providers and so on. And so could we do a pilot that looked about how could we link across the community from the providers in ambulatory practices to the providers in the inpatient setting at Holy Cross. And so we did some of that work to coordinate the medication, the education, the dietary care, sharing information across those sites in November of 2006. And then there was a great deal of interest also in, well, how can we do some reporting on some of the mandated screening tests, a little different from the lab test. This was abnormal newborn hearing screening. And we worked again with the folks at Holy Cross Hospital in Taos and did successfully kind of pilot test that process to debug it and to look at things. Now, as often happens, some of these things, I hate to say, but one of my friends calls it, in the end, lipstick on a pig. Isn't that a charming name? I believe we've heard that from political discussions. But it was sometimes to do the early pilots, they don't always sustain, but they teach you just an enormous amount that can be the foundation for later progress. And again, we've been very appreciative of both AHRQ and Taos Holy Cross for working with us for all the lessons that we got out of that. So the other issue we think in our state, and I think this has been a real strength from the first, is we're just too small a state to waste resources and to duplicate resources. So we thought, not only do we need to collaborate, but we need to really make sure that we know what's going on in other HIT efforts so that we aren't all doing some of the same things or at cross purposes. And so we sit on a lot of different boards to make sure that we know what's going on. We have a number of people from, especially in the area of telehealth, but also electronic health records that sit on our board. And we, in turn, sit on the board of the New Mexico Telehealth Alliance, for example. So along the way, that's always been critical to us, and I think one of our strengths. We did have, I know that, trying to think if it was Angela or one of the other colleagues at AHRQ, was the project director for Project ECHO, which was one of the other AHRQ HIT grants in the state. And they just did an outstanding job, led by Dr. Sanjeev Arora of the University of New Mexico, in working to both have telehealth links, but the goal was really like telehealth outreach for disease management to enable rural primary care providers to interact with specialists, but also to get them empowered. It was funded by AHRQ, the New Mexico Legislature, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and has become quite a well-known initiative around the country, and we have worked with them as well. They started with a pilot disease, hepatitis C, that many rural practitioners have almost no notion of how to take care of, and then they've moved on to be a model for managing other complex diseases in rural communities with an emphasis, which I really like, on not just linking rural practitioners to specialists, but really empowering them. And frankly, they have gotten some major awards, including a very interesting $5 million award from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation as one of three top disruptive innovation programs in the country. The issue, however, is that as wonderful as what they're doing is, it could be even more wonderful if there were electronic health records in the rural areas and if they're so that they had information at the point of care and if they could share that back and forth by the Health Information Exchange. And so we're working with Dr. Arora and his group in that area. We're also working on with Project HOPE and United Healthcare and Philips on a rural telemonitoring initiative where there are cases in our rural areas where there simply are not good links even to the Internet, and we're working to see if we can link telemonitoring with the information exchange and gearing up those areas to have better access to in the rural areas to healthcare that will keep them healthy and out of the hospital. what are the barriers? And these won't be probably brand new to those of you that have done any of this kind of work, but it's certainly in our area, poverty is the, you know, I had a friend that thought that all doctors are automatically rich. I think that really is not the case, and it's especially not the case in rural areas in New Mexico. There are really dedicated folks that are doing a wonderful job out there and do without many resources. We also, as I mentioned, sometimes have insufficient bandwidth, internet infrastructure to support some of the HIT things we'd like to do. And always when you're small, there are a lack of financial, clinical, and IT resources to implement EHRs and telemedicine. We talked a bit about the regional extension centers to deal with that and to link them to the telemedicine efforts in our state. There's also, change is hard for all of us, and that is certainly true in rural New Mexico, clinician resistance to change, and that's typical. Inadequate reimbursement for things like telehealth. There are still not, you know, we still don't have a clear future for sustainability. And something we had underestimated was the privacy and security concerns regarding data disclosure. I will have to tell you it is insufficient to think that HIPAA and compliance with HIPAA will take care of that, because you have a lot of state laws in many states that are more rigorous than HIPAA for sensitive conditions. So that's another issue one has to take a look at. On the other hand, ironically, some of the negatives, like insufficient specialists, means that there's an impetus to share resources and to use telemedicine to extend our workforce and our specialists. And in some ways that can say, yes, we really do need to implement HIT. It would really help rural practitioners. And the other is, in our state, a lot of stakeholders go to the same meetings. That may be bad in some ways, but it's wonderful that the relationships really foster improved collaboration. And there is only one medical school. And sometimes if you're in other urban areas and so on where there are lots of medical schools, there's so much competition about who gets to control what that it helps to have just one. The other is that we have a history of innovation in healthcare. We have long had this close collaboration among HIT initiatives because we know we need to collaborate, that if you're poor, a poor state and rural state, you know you have to. And one of the things we've cared about a whole lot is how do we make sure that there is inclusion of rural health providers in our governance structure. And I think that that has been appreciated, and they have been very actively engaged, and I've really been excited about that. So lessons learned in the HIT trenches from our very own Dr. Carolyn Clancy at AHRQ. As she said, and as a sociologist, I appreciate this, it is less about the technology than the sociology. I think that is true, meaning that technical things are daunting, but the sociological and issues of competition and innovation and all that, they are even more difficult. But I have to tell you that because technology is expensive and still evolving, I think both of them are hard. I think knowing up front, and some of these are more general lessons about HIT than just about rural, that I think if you know up front and you even hire for that, that people that can tolerate the fact that innovation is always messy and challenging and always takes longer than you want it to. But if you can keep being resilient, one of my friends at the University of New Mexico said, remember, Maggie, the name of the game is persistence beyond all reason. And I think that that is absolutely true. If you have folks that are going to expect it to be linear, that probably won't work for you. And then the other thing is kind of a big surprise to us, because we were researchers and thought we knew about HIPAA and privacy, but we found a whole lot. It's a major issue. So if you're working in this area or you're interested, never underestimate how difficult and important privacy concerns are, and you need to be very working with others around the country and in your community to address them. Again, assure a balance of rural and urban stakeholders. They're really important, and most states have rural aspects. The other is sometimes we would have people in our own group that were used to competition, and I just have to say that if you've got to have a collaborative group, you've got to believe that it's about bringing people together, and you've got to share the wealth. I just think you have to hire that way too. And again, sometimes we would think that we knew what was going on, in our community and what they valued in HIT services, and we would ask them and find that we weren't right. So you really do need to ask them and listen. And lastly, what has really helped us is, on a bad day, just always, always keep your sense of humor. That's part of that persistence beyond all reason thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gunter. I will take this moment to brag that, yes, I am the project officer for Dr. Obora's grant out of New Mexico. We'll now hear from Dr. Gorman, who will present findings from his ARC-funded project as well, which aims to improve medication safety for elderly populations in rural areas. Dr. Gorman, the floor is yours.
Good morning. If I can't be heard, somebody please notify me. You should be now looking at the first slide, which says the RX Safe Project, Improving Medication Safety for Rural Elders. The picture in the background is the town in which this research took place. It's Lincoln City on the Oregon coast. It's a town of about 5,000. I think Oregon is perhaps not quite as rural or remote as parts of New Mexico, although in Oregon we have actually three levels of rural defined by the Office of Rural Health, because there's some fairly remote and sparsely populated parts of this state. In any case, we chose Lincoln City because we think it's both atypical and typical for this kind of project. Atypical in the sense that they already had a very high level of IT adoption in the doctor's offices, hospitals, and so forth, pharmacies, but typical in that the IT adoption that they had was completely kind of random. So there's no two organizations that are part of the same larger organization, no two entities that have the same technology, the same software, and so forth. So we thought it kind of represented the sort of challenge that's going to be present across the country as we try to connect practices and hospitals and so forth with health information. Now, let me first tell you about a motivating case. It's a kind of a typical case of the sort that we face in practice all the time. A woman came to the clinic. She had been a 69-year-old woman who was bright and functional. She had diabetes and was being treated with a very complicated insulin regimen. She also had high blood pressure, and for that she was being treated with a beta blocker. And, of course, beta blockers block some of our responses to low blood sugar, which creates a problem. In any case, this 69-year-old woman developed severe memory loss and cognitive dysfunction, and she had to move from her independent living situation to foster care, where other people gave her medication. She came to the clinic one day, having had a blood sugar that was 29 the evening before and over 400 the following morning. And so we were forced to ask ourselves, to try to solve her problem, what is her diabetic regimen supposed to be? What are the correct medications for this person? What should we change about those medications, and how should we communicate that to everyone involved in her care? So it seems simple. We should just look in the electronic record or look in her medical record, but it turns out there's lots of medical records. The foster care facility faxed us a copy of their medical record. The primary care physician, that was us, we had her records in an electronic health record. Her daughter had been carefully keeping in a notebook a record of all the medications and changes. Turned out she had a diabetologist who'd been managing things by phone, and there are probably our other records in this patient's case from the hospital and from various pharmacies. And so when looking for the correct medication record, the problem became which one's correct. If you've done any long-term care, you know that there's almost no way to know which medication list is correct. Here are two lists. One is the discharge hospital list from a hospital. The other is a medication administration record from a nursing home. What we see when we look at these lists from pharmacies, doctor's offices, the patient's refrigerator, is that there's a lot of variation among them that's necessary. After all, the people using the list are performing different tasks. Pharmacists do a different task than prescribers. Nurses administering the medicine have a different task than a patient or their caregiver at home. They also are very different in terms of the user expertise, and they're very different in terms of the data needs. So it's natural that these systems would be very different and the lists would be different. But there's also a lot of unhelpful variation. Much of this comes from non-adherence to standards. And I have to say that it's not quite the case that there are no standards, but it is mostly the case that standards aren't being used. And so when you look at these lists, it's very hard to find information systems that record medication information in the same way. And that makes it very hard to translate. The other part of the unhelpful variation that we observed is that there's very little, if any, coordination between the various organizations that take care of the patient. And I'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. So the result of all this is that the medication information for patients, just like much of the rest of the information for patients, resides in silos that are pretty much separate and independent. As this slide reminds us, there are specialized IT applications for hospitals, doctors, pharmacies, and patients, and that's okay. They need them to be specialized for their purposes. But because they're not coordinated and integrated anyway, we miss the benefits of human and of computerized support. Decision support technologies, drug interaction checking, drug duplication checking, all those things can't work if the list is incomplete. So our project in this rural town was to try to address this problem by creating a single list that was accurate, complete, and current, and basically put everyone on the same page, whether it's the prescribing physician, a pharmacist who's dispensing medication, nurses or other staff in rehab centers that are administering medication, and all of the parties who monitor medication. We wanted them all to be on the same page. And this is a fairly daunting challenge, although it seems simple. We're only restricting our health information exchange to one kind of information. So we thought there were three requirements to achieve this, and I'll talk a little bit about each of these requirements and the extent to which we were able to get there. These would be collaboration among all the parties involved, connection among all the systems involved, and integration so that our technology didn't create yet another application and yet another piece of workflow and yet another form for people to fill out, which, of course, always meets with more resistance because people generally don't like to have their work increased. So with respect to collaboration, here's a proposed, basically the proposed collaboration starts with our project, RxSafe, in the middle. And to keep things simple, we thought, let's start just with those people who are in long-term care facilities. Two assisted living facilities, this one and this one, and a skilled nursing facility. So between those three facilities, there's about 150 patients. Now, if you want to get to all of their prescribers, you've got to talk to four different clinics, Bayshore Family Medicine, Lincoln City Medical Center, and two others, four different clinics in the town. And then if you want to get to all the pharmacies that prescribe for them, those are these six entities over on the right, two long-term care pharmacies, preferred and senior, and four retail chains, all of which provide medications for some of the patients in these facilities. And finally, you've got to connect to the hospital. And what's noticeable about this, first of all, is that you've got to connect to a lot of organizations if you want to track medications and keep track of medications for a relatively small number of patients. The second thing is that all of these organizations are independent of one another. There's no formal relationship among them that might lead them to share information in an effective way. And the third observation is that many of them are actually not local, even though we're in a small town on a remote part of the Oregon coast. We're dealing with national entities, and so if you want to get agreements from these folks, you may be talking to someone in New York or Phoenix or Chicago, even though you're just trying to solve a problem on the coast of Oregon. The upshot of all that is what we end up with is a much smaller subset of organizations that actually decide to get engaged. Because of these multiple, distinct, competing, often national entities, only a small number decide to get engaged, and others are free, of course, to decide to participate or not participate. And this problem, which we call organizational interoperability, we found to be one of the most formidable. The second thing that we needed to achieve was connection. This slide reminds us that this problem of getting organizations to collaborate is not that easy. And here are just two examples. On the top right is the Santa Barbara Rio, which you recall was the very, very successful model Rio for the nation back in the early 2000s. But by 2000, it had finally collapsed. Here's another example from my own state. Here in Portland, there was an attempt to create a citywide health information exchange that involved all the large entities that keep track of patient information in our city. But that was not successful, even though we're a pretty technologically up-to-speed state. where 59% of physicians in our region already have electronic health records, it's still difficult to get those records to be connected. So the other thing we needed is connection. Ideally, this would be standards-based connection between different organizations that achieve immediate exchange, so that whether you're in the primary care office making a change in the electronic health record, over at the pharmacy dispensing medicines, perhaps in the nursing home administering medicines, or at the hospital, ideally, all of these entities would have standards-based recording of information and be able to exchange it practically in real time, so that as soon as one makes a change, the others would reflect it. For a variety of reasons, we've not been able to achieve that, or it's been very, very difficult. The first is that we've had to go one by one to create the connections. It turns out, and it's not surprising, of course, that there are unique organizational policies, and every one of these entities has their own policies for their IT department, how things are going to be done, how they share information with other organizations, in part because although HIPAA is one piece of legislation, there are as many different interpretations of it as there are entities that have to deal with it. And so you have unique organizational policies that you have to deal with before you can actually even get in there and start creating a technical connection. After that, there's the problem of unique electronic medical record implementations, where even if two entities use the same software, they often implement it in different ways, and it's not trivial to get them connected. Another issue is simply that each organization owns the data themselves and is responsible for it, so no organization is going to want you to change information in their record system. What we end up with then is a system that provides a window into other medication lists and is updated nightly but isn't quite current. It's, I'd have to say, recent. And here's what the system looks like as we built it. It provides a clinician with what we call status at a glance, details on demand, which is a motto that I learned at a NASA seminar. What you see here is an RxSafe list where patients' medications are being viewed. There are four columns. What's happened here is four different entities have been discovered to have medication information about this patient, and we can display that and see what each entity, the Lincoln City Medical Center, the Lincoln City Rehab Center, the BuyRight Pharmacy, what each entity thinks this patient's supposed to be on. And this enables a clinician to at least get a sense for what the variation is and to be able to put that information to work. The third thing we needed to do was integration. And the way that we managed integration into workflow, here's an example. Our RxSafe screen allows an individual to inspect the medication lists from multiple centers. And we use the hospital's medication reconciliation form and produce a replica of it electronically that allows a nurse, for example, in the emergency department to have the medications from one of these lists printed on the form, which they can then take right to the bedside. And this, we hoped, would integrate the use of our system into a task that they already needed to perform and make it more useful to them, which it turned out it was. In fact, we piloted this in the emergency department, and it pretty much spontaneously spread throughout the hospital as other departments that needed to do tasks like this became aware of it. They started using it over in pre-op admitting and in other places. And people who worked in the hospital figured out how to get this onto their computers so that they could use it. At the bottom half of this slide is CATS's diffusion model that talks about whether the promoter of the technology is aware that they're promoting it and whether the adopter is aware that it's being promoted. For example, if the promoter is aware and the adopter is aware, then that's persuasion. If the promoter isn't aware they're promoting it but the adopter is, that's imitation. And what we think happened in our situation would be contagion, where there wasn't any real adoption plan. In fact, we weren't planning to spread it through the hospital, but it spread on its own. This spread, though, was limited by critical mass of data, and as Maggie was talking about having such a very, very large number of patients in their system, that will make it much more useful because this is only attractive to users to the extent that it's likely to contain information that they want. The other big limitation, of course, is the accuracy. And the information in our system is only as good as the information in the systems from which it draws. And so that's another thing that users said was a concern for them. Let me just mention the major challenges that we found. First of all, technical interoperability. As I've mentioned, standards are not being enforced by system developers. They're being used sort of as needed. And that produces a situation where systems aren't ready to be connected as well as they might. If we had some kind of enforcement of standards, we'd be partway there. But that's a necessary but not sufficient stage for getting health information exchange because of the need for organizational interoperability. There are many reasons for this. Among them are these I've listed. Commercial proprietary concerns. In many cases, we're asking organizations that are used to competing with one another to share information, and that's not something they're used to doing. There are significant regulatory and privacy concerns, as the more an organization opens its information to other users, the more they are vulnerable to breaking rules and compromising patient privacy. There's also the problem of a need for return on investment. And if this problem of health information exchange is viewed in this business sense and requires a return on investment for the organizations that invest in it, it's going to be a very, very slow process because at the moment there's not a lot of return. Now, you'll notice that I spell this organizational in the European way with an S as opposed to a Z, and that's because if you spell it this way and Google it, you'll find that folks in Europe have been working on this problem for a long time and have understood a lot more right now about how to get organizations to connect and interoperate effectively. Finally, there's a misalignment of costs and benefits, and like with the electronic medical record in primary care, there's a no concordance between those who benefit from the use of the system and those who have to pay for creating and maintaining it. Some observations about our system. First, users seem to like it. It spontaneously spread beyond where we installed it, so we feel that's a sign of that. And I think that's mainly because of the task integration. It helped them do a task they already had to do, and it made it faster and more accurate. Second observation is that medication lists as they currently exist are a mess. When you really get down and look what's in there and how they're stored in electronic systems, it's always a surprise. That's what my software engineers tell me. The third thing is that reconciliation is actually very hard, and one thing we noticed in our work with different organizations is that they are all spending a lot of time, expert clinician time, looking at lists, reviewing lists, trying to make sure they're correct. And because the existing systems don't share this information, most of that effort of having nurses and pharmacists and doctors review lists is wasted because the next organization down the line can't benefit from that work. To get to sustainability, which we hoped for, we had people say, don't take this away, but we realized we needed to do some other things to make it better. One was to add patients, and again, the larger that master patient index of patients you've got in there, the more useful it is. The second thing we needed to do was add systems, and we started to target systems that are used in a lot of doctor's offices because each one of these gives us more bang for the buck in terms of our technical work. It would also be useful for a system like ours to have different kinds of information like allergies and diagnoses. And finally, we started to work on some functions that a system like ours could provide that would make it more useful to users, including these. Meaningful presentation, assisted reconciliation, enhancing collaboration, and web-based decision support. And that's the process that our current project, which is a follow-up project funded by ARC, is all about. For the sake of time, I think I'll stop there and answer any questions later on.
Thanks, Dr. Gorman. Also, thank you for pointing that out. I want to remind you that at any time during the presentations, you can feel free to send in any questions that you have using the Q&A tab. Our final speaker today will be Mr. John Kravitz. He is going to conclude the teleconference by discussing Geisinger Health System's Health Information Exchange and some new efforts to improve their health information exchange in rural Pennsylvania. And he will also talk about incorporating telemedicine into their healthcare efforts. John, the floor is all yours.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I did want to talk about our efforts and a special thank you to the ARC Foundation because we've really taken a lot of resources and been very fortunate to get those resources in order to deploy and build out our health information exchange and make it a true community collaborative. What I'd like to start with is if you could think back to 18 to 24 months ago when now President Barack Obama was during his campaigning, he had talked about healthcare reform and he talked about Geisinger Health System located in rural Pennsylvania. And I'd like to now show you one of our campuses and give you a little background on the organization. This is one of our campuses. We are an integrated delivery network. This is the campus that he refers to in Danville. It is our corporate campus. We have another campus that is also just about the same size in northeastern Pennsylvania, in the Wilkes-Barre-Scranton area near the Pocono Mountain region, if you've heard of that area. But what I'd like to detail for you is some of the background of our organization and then go on to the health information exchange. We do have two acute care hospitals, as I've talked about. We have a children's hospital as well, and we have specialty centers for health and cancer research. In addition, women's hospital and women's center and drug and alcohol treatment centers, which are not part of these two campuses. In addition to that, we do have ambulatory surgery centers, and you can see on the bottom of that screen, we do about 30,000 admissions and about 800 inpatient beds, which is not a whole heck of a lot, but we really try to focus on quality and outcomes measurement as part of our mission, and we do utilize information technology extremely heavily throughout our organization. Our leadership, fortunately, being in the IT area, really looks at IT as an enabler for the organization. In our care team, we have 800 employed physicians, primarily made up of PCPs, medical specialists, and hospitalists, which could be in our facilities or in other outlying community hospital settings. We do have 40 community practice settings. We call them community practice site location CPSLs. We do about 1.5 million visits per year in those locations. And in addition to that, we do our teaching facility. So we have 220-plus interns and residents, which are going through rotations, three-year rotations typically for specialty areas throughout our facilities. What we have been noticing is that our balance of business has been shifting. As we've heard for years, it's going to change from the inpatient to the ambulatory setting. And just this year, we finally surpassed revenue totals in the ambulatory setting beyond the 50% mark. So we're about $2.5 billion a year net revenue, just to give you an idea of size. Not a large organization compared to some integrated delivery networks in the country. However, we are in a growth stage. And the last component of our integrated delivery network really consists of our health plan. Currently, the numbers are a little higher. We're about 250,000 members in that plan. We do offer commercial Medicare and TPA plans. And we are contracted with those facilities as seen below, about 1,000 physicians and 80 hospitals. This is our primary service area. It's a 31-county service area. About 2.6 million residents reside in these 31 counties. Pennsylvania itself, we are not anywhere near our exchange deployed as Maggie's is throughout the whole state of New Mexico. We have about 67 counties in our entire state of Pennsylvania, and so we have 31 as our service area. So we are continuing to grow. There are 53 hospitals in the service area, and it's comprised of approximately 9,000 physicians in this 31-county region. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about our health information exchange that we had created. Started by doing some exploration back in 2005 and got it operational, and it's been operational in stages and steps. We started operationalizing this in April of 2007. We currently have 13 members in a loose collaborative for this organization, and that membership consists of hospitals, long-term care centers, home health agencies, physicians' practices, and ambulatory clinics as well. So currently, we are populating data into our health exchange from 7 different acute care hospitals and 42 clinics. And those clinics primarily are the clinics that are comprised from Geisinger at this point in time. However, I will share with you, we have a major growth plan underway to establish and connect hospital clinics throughout our communities. We do have it currently in 4 emergency departments that are using it and using it very, very heavily. And we're going to the 5th within the next month or so. We'll have 5 departments online. About 2.9, close to 3 million records in our master patient index. So 3 million. We actually have more than, if you recall the prior slide, patients than in our service area. So people that are transient are also coming in and out of the service area. Again, about 300 users, and the key and the trick to the whole exchange is the governance of the exchange. It's not necessarily the technology, although that's fraught with challenges, but it is getting the patients to authorize access to their records. In Pennsylvania, there are three protected areas of health information that require sign-off by the patient so that those records are accessible to other healthcare providers. And so our funding stream, it actually started back in 2005. We had an ARC planning grant for about $200,000 to start planning out our health exchange. We had an implementation grant of $1.5 million back in 2007, as I stated, to launch the exchange. We did have a Pennsylvania Department of Health grant for another $500,000. And then most recently, we were awarded in April of this year a grant to extend the exchange, to build it out for functionality, and to build out as far as further expansion for the implementation of other members into the exchange. So what I'd like to show you is this is our current deployment into KEHI. KEHI stands for Keystone Health Information Exchange. So we currently have 7 hospitals that are populating data into the exchange. And going forward, we will actually, with the deployment of the ARC grant over the next 3 to 5 years, and you'll see the timeline in the next slide, we will be populating these other providers into the exchange and then beyond this. But this is applicable to the ARC grant funding. So we'll be bringing on a few more hospital systems into the exchange, also home health agencies, most importantly, our physicians' practices and long-term care centers. I'd like to show you just a very brief, simple timeline for expansion of the health information exchange as it relates to the ARC grant that we've recently received, and that is connecting in year one two of the healthcare centers. Let me grab my little pointer. So the two of the healthcare centers would be connected. A physician's family practice center, which actually consists of 22 sites. So this will actually be our first connectivity outside of our owned organization. We are going to be populating, we actually have already started populating for our organization, laboratory results into the exchange and then adding document distribution. Year two, we're going to be going into the home health agencies, and then most folks probably have heard, if you've done any work or had any prior research on health information exchange, a continuity of care document, or a CCD. Continuity of care document, the value and the beauty of it is both human-readable and machine-readable, in that it's a great interoperable tool to be able to exchange information amongst other electronic health records. So there are subsets, just to give you an idea of what the CCD is comprised of, and this is just a small group of the subsets of it. There are many, many more. But you can have the demographic information from the patient, their family and social history. You can have allergies, your medications, drug interactions. You can have problem lists, lab results, radiology results, reports, consult reports, so on and so forth. So there are a number of different components of the CCD, but that is the method that we've chosen, and that is the IHE standard to proceed with interoperability between different diverse electronic health record systems. So one of the things that Paul had alluded to and talked a great deal about and an awful lot of work, and I commend you guys for the work you've done on this, is the medication histories, and we plan on bringing that into an exchange by utilizing some tools like SureScripts and RxHub and using RxNorm to try to normalize that data and standardize it coming into the exchange. It's only as good as the information that's collected, as others before me have stated. So it's very important that we are very diligent in getting it from multiple sources, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more on future slides. Event notification is another area that I will elaborate upon with the care managers and the physicians. Primary care physicians. And finally, in years 3 to 5, we're going to be going off to long-term care centers, connected to them. Emergency responders. So what I'm referring to here are either ambulance services. We have 7 helicopters that are part of our network that we fly patients in from all over the place in our 31-county area or beyond. And we're planning on outfitting those choppers as well with access to KEHI. So if they're flying to an emergency situation and it can be identified through the 911 command center, at least bring up all the information on the patient so when they get there, they can react accordingly, knowing what kind of problems they might have beyond the emergent situation if they're flying to a car accident or whatever else. So we hope that can help expedite the care for those patients. And, of course, we're going to do further deployment with build-out of complete CCD document population, adding physician consult reports, electrocardiograms, pathology reports, so on and so forth. And so just real briefly, you know, I think others have touched upon this too, but redundancy. There's a lot of redundancy, and of course, Paul had talked about silos in healthcare. Well, there are silos all over the place, and we've seen this in our community settings where radiology procedures are duplicated, costing potentially the patient if they're denied for another radiology study, or costing the healthcare system, whether it's Medicare, medical assistance, or the private healthcare system. So on average, giving an idea of volumes based upon what we're seeing and where we expect that we can see some real substantial savings. On average, it's $60 per procedure. We do just under $1 million per year, equating to about $10.9 million of potential savings. And again, potential is the key. And we're looking to get real, true outcomes data in order to sell this for further sustainability of our health information exchange. Same applies to lab tests, and to take you through it, and just bottom line, it's about a $14 million potential savings based upon our current volumes. So to give you an idea what that slide is referring to. In this case, we're referring to PCP office visits and emergency department visits and the potential savings. Not quite as great, but still, it's savings of about $3.3 million based upon our volumes. And in total, this is just a kind of a recap potential savings through use of the health information exchange, about $28 million. So, you know, it's something to look forward to. I know in our state of Pennsylvania, they're trying to get a statewide health information exchange established and looking for sustainability of that. They do have federal money to start it, but they're really struggling with how they're going to sustain it. And I think Maggie alluded to that as well. So the key, though, is to show those tangible outcomes and true savings to the insurance carriers and try to get them to pony up, so to speak, to be able to support the exchange and to keep it sustainable, because it really is all about treatment of the patient. So just to give you an idea of where we are, just real quick graphics, these are the seven hospitals and the clinics that are currently populating the exchange. But looking into the state further, I had mentioned that we have 53 hospitals. So there's all kinds of growth in our 31-county service area. And if you look at adding into that, all the nursing homes that are part of it. So there's an awful lot of siloed information that's just not getting out to treat that patient effectively. And you can see where there's value here to bring the exchange to fruition and further getting it deployed. What I'd like to talk about is our health plan presence, because I did indicate that we do have an integrated delivery network. And so we do have three major service areas out west in Central County, the Geisinger Medical Center in the central area, and in the northeast. These are the clinics that are actually part of the Geisinger Health System that populate data to the exchange. And we also have some convenient healthcare sites called CareWorks, which are the green triangles that you've seen overlaid. Those, and coupled with external physicians that are not employed by the physician or by the healthcare system, are the red dots that are depicted on this graph. What we're trying to deploy and share here is information is so critical throughout the healthcare delivery network. Now, fortunately for Geisinger, we do have a longitudinal electronic healthcare record, both for inpatient and for ambulatory settings. So we have all the information we basically need, but there are other healthcare providers that have an electronic health record, but it's not communicating past their four walls, if you will. So that's where the health information exchange really comes into play. What I'd like to talk about is further build out of our health information exchange, and something that we were very, very fortunate. We were one of 15 organizations that were awarded the Beacon Communities Grant. And If you're not familiar with that, that is a federal grant that was part of the new health care reform bill. And the intent of this grant is to be able to provide further extending our existing health care resources out to more and more people that will be part of the health care reform. I think they estimated 30 million more people coming into the system. So, and how are they going to be able to handle that? Well, the idea behind the Keystone Beacon Community Grants and the program itself is to extend care and try to eliminate or work very diligently to eliminate readmissions for certain chronic disease conditions and also for post-operative surgery conditions. So it is a case management model. We do have, if you've ever heard of, a medical home model. So you're actually, care manager is managing the care of that patient regardless of where that patient is within a system. So they can be anywhere in a healthcare system. They could be in a physician's practice. They could be in a hospital setting, in a long-term care or home health setting, and they could even be in their home setting. So the idea behind this is our focus initially will be on a couple of chronic disease conditions, congestive heart failure or CHF, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder or COPD, and of course postoperative surgeries. So we want to eliminate, we already have some ideas on how we can do this, but eliminate readmissions within a 30-day window of time from a patient being discharged from an acute care facility or emergency department visits for those patients if they're being managed and monitored appropriately. So the Keystone Beacon community, again, those are the three conditions that we're going to be monitoring initially. The care team does consist of care managers, primary care physicians, the hospitals, the emergency department teams. They're all part of it. We're going to be using enhanced healthcare IT. So this will be the health exchange. This will be tying in and integrating electronic health records from physicians' practices in their offices, hospitals, electronic health records, and also a care management system that's very advanced. We're looking at doing population-level preventative care. So the idea, and I will show you on a future slide, is when a patient may have had an episode and they were either in an ED or they would have been discharged from an acute care facility with one of these chronic disease conditions, that'll trigger alerts and events that will trigger a number of different initiatives going through the process to enhance the care for that patient. The idea is the outcomes down here in the green box are feedback to the care team, which effectively will reduce costs and improve marketability of the program. Going forward into year two and three, it is a three-year grant. We will be extending into diabetes and coronary artery disease as well as other chronic disease conditions. Just to give you a little idea of the process flow, and I did talk about the admission discharge notification process. So if we're looking over here at a hospital setting, basically a patient's discharged, so a notification would go through the exchange and trigger an event, which will do a message coming through the exchange as well as a transaction set, which will go out and trigger into the care management system as well as into the primary care physician system to let them know. They may not have been the person that would have done either the attending or the referring physician in this case. The patient may have come through with a CHF or COPD condition through the emergency department and been admitted to the hospital, unbeknownst to the physician or the care manager at that point in time. So upon either admission or discharge, that would trigger these events to go through and notify those particular care providers so they could start their care process. And it's typically within 48 hours of discharge. Patient will be notified, medications will be reconciled, and the process begins. Secure messaging, I talked about that, is a complete encrypted messaging through the health exchange. And that process can either start by the patient, off to the care manager and the physician, or can go vice versa, the care manager to the patient and physician, or physician, care manager, and patient. But the idea behind it is it's continuous communication. The patient can come in through a portal. The physician can do it either through their inbox messaging in their electronic health record, and the care manager can do the messaging from the case management system and trigger events back and forth. And medication reconciliation, an area where Paul has done an inordinate amount of work in Oregon, is the last area that I just wanted to show you a high-level overview of how it would work. The idea behind it is the patient can have medications from the home setting, or the care manager can have updated medications. And that can go through from the physician's interaction going off to PBMs or the medication clearinghouse and individual pharmacies. It could even be the pharmacy chain with $4 scripts like Target or Walmart or you name it, any of the major retail pharmacies that are in that business, just to be able to get the information, get it reconciled back so that at least the physician is aware of it. The primary care is the main keeper. The care manager is the facilitator to work with the primary care physician in order to move this forward. We have a program that we have in place for a number of years. It's called Proven Health Navigator, which utilizes a number of these things, but they're not in a truly integrated solution. There are a number of different processes. Some are on paper. Some are requiring the care manager to log into different electronic health records. With the Keystone Beacon Community Initiative and using the Health Information Exchange, we will be able to tie all those together and have it a seamless process for both the patient, especially the physician, the care manager, and the hospital setting care providers. So I'd just like to say thank you for your time and pass it back over.
Thank you, John. At this time, I want to remind the audience that you will see a survey pop up at this time, and AHRQ really does appreciate you taking the time to fill out that survey, and we use your feedback. So if you could take the time to do that, that would be great. And we are now going to move into the question and answer portion of the national teleconference. Again, you can submit questions using your Q&A tab on your screen. We have a few questions. Some are for the whole group, and then some are for specific presenters. So let's go ahead. Oh, and I guess let me also mention there were a couple questions about materials. In case you're interested in getting the slides downloaded today, you can go to the materials tab and click on the slide handouts, and that's where you can get it. Additionally, 2 to 4 weeks after the teleconference, it varies. We will also have the materials posted on the healthit.ahrq.gov website under our events tab on the left-hand side. So let's get started with some questions for the whole panel. The first question would be, how do infrastructure and internet coverage issues affect rural IT initiatives? Are there particular challenges that urban settings aren't faced with?
This is Maggie Gunter in New Mexico. Certainly, there are significant issues in the rural areas. And in fact, the Center for Telemedicine at the University of New Mexico, Dale Alverson, that some of you may know, has been working for some time with an FCC, a large FCC grant, to try to provide broadband opportunities out in the rural areas because there are dead spots and inability to even use the internet as much as we all think is usual. There's not much in the way of T1 lines and so on. So I think some of those federal programs are, you know, certainly important in some of these rural areas. Are any of the rest of you, John or Paul, finding that? Of course, you have an unusual rural area in Geisinger with that great integrated system, John.
Well, I can talk to that, Maggie. Actually, I was down in Washington as part of a National Rural Health Administration group that was pulled together about 2 weeks ago, and The intent of that group was to respond to the FCC broadband initiative and actually expansion of that in the rural settings. And I think, fortunately for us, we don't have that scenario. Even though we are classified as a rural setting, we do have a lot of internet connectivity and a lot of high-speed bandwidth. But that is not the case in a lot of areas, especially you are stating your organization is a frontier state, so to speak. And I know there are a number of frontier states that have those problems. And I think part of the initiative going forward is to look at the grant funding possibilities. And I think FCC is very, very concerned about having the bandwidth in place to be able to support health information exchanges, telemedicine, other initiatives, which are really going to require that. And there is certainly a push at this point in time to be able to move forward with contractors, to be able to get out to those rural areas, whether it is wireless in very remote locations and hopefully not mountainous locations that wouldn't interfere, or laying fiber in the ground in those areas. And that seems to be the impetus going forward to be able to alleviate some of that shortcoming that we're experiencing out in those areas.
I agree. And one of the things anything AHRQ can do is I'm not sure if the, because we all so appreciate this FCC opportunity, but there's been something like $400 million were available, and very, very little of that actually got spent. So it's one of those things in rural areas where we, even where there are folks that are working with the rural areas to help them, there's still always these bureaucratic impediments sometimes to actually, I think FCC really wants these dollars to go out, but sometimes it seems like there are so many impediments that that the actual dollars have largely not gone out, and that makes us all kind of sad. So anything folks can do at the federal level to help the FCC with those issues, that would be wonderful.
Paul, I would add this, that when you talk about the resources being made available but then not being utilized, one of the things that strikes me in working with rural communities in Oregon and California is that the infrastructure assumptions of things like a grant, you know, we're in these big medical centers and health centers where if you want to get a grant, there's a whole department or several that do that. And when you're in these small rural communities, there's no infrastructure even to figure out how to apply for a grant. And so I think one of the things that slows down this process that the larger centers, be they academic centers, health systems, whatever, can do is provide the infrastructure to help the small community figure out even what's out there. Because they simply don't have a budget department and a grants department and a HIPAA department to figure all this stuff out for them. It's just, half the time for us, the technical support is somebody's nephew who knows how to get the printer working.
That's totally right. I think that places like the Primary Care Association that represents a lot of the federally qualified health centers that are these rural clinics that serve the underserved, sometimes because they're bigger themselves can provide some of those, opportunities. You're exactly right about the grant writing, just as we saw across the board. Resources, a lot of smart people in rural areas, but just resources are spread so much thinner that I think sometimes we have actually helped some of the rural areas to write grants. And I think that as we see some of these clinical and translational science awards going out from NIH to the big academic health centers, and they really want that kind of outreach and community engagement. And I think that that's another piece that ought to be part of some of these CTSAs. There's a lot of money that's going out, and there really needs to be, I think, academic health centers are starting to recognize that they really need to be in their states and for the nation kind of the vanguard of helping, whereas, frankly, Geisinger's and Lovelace's and others have actually been more in the vanguard of translational work. They really need to be the folks that aren't just in silos and doing that research in silos, but really reaching out to saying, what's our responsibility for improving health in our state? And I think that that's starting to happen as part of healthcare transformation.
Okay, thank you. Another question for the whole panel. Have critical access hospitals and FQHCs been engaged in any of your three projects?
Again, it's Maggie. Certainly in the we've been working with the FQH, the Primary Care Association, which represents the FQHCs, has been an active member of our board and our steering committee for the HIE for some time. They're frankly more actively involved now that we're doing heading the the HIT Regional Extension Center, and they're one of our major partners, along with the NMRA, New Mexico Medical Review Association, which is the, you know, state's QIO. So that has really, when you really are partnering distinctly on a real initiative and a real funded grant, I think that makes it even more real. And so that's been exciting to us, to really be working hand-in-hand with the Primary Care Association, which is very much representing the federally qualified health centers. So that's, we're working distinctly more closely with them on the Regional Extension Center initiative than we even had before.
Either of the other two presenters?
Yeah, could you repeat that question, please? My phone seemed to cut out for a moment. I missed most of the question, so I apologize.
No problem. Have Critical Access Hospitals and FQHCs been engaged in your project?
Oh, this is John. Yeah, I'd like to say it has been. They have been considerably, especially north of our area, which becomes very, very rural. And we have a lot of critical access hospitals. And as Maggie had indicated and Paul, we do a lot. We have a large grant writing department and research department at Geisinger. However, we work with community hospitals, and we were able to get, for the most part, high-speed internet connections for those hospitals through grant writing, and I believe it was a 85-15 split. So they were responsible for 15% of the cost, and the rest of it was funded through the FCC grant. And most of those connections were like 10 megabit connections to their locations. So that was beneficial for critical access hospitals especially. And some of the telemedicine initiatives, which I also have the responsibility at Geisinger for all of telemedicine from the IT support perspective, we've been doing number of things for electronic ICU, telestroke, and teletrauma transfer, and radiology, and everything else as part of that initiative. So doing those services and providing those services at no charge to the community hospitals, this bandwidth really has been very helpful.
And just a little follow-up on what John was saying. I hadn't mentioned the critical access hospitals, and they are the good news that they were recently added by the Office of the National Coordinator to receive technical assistance under the Regional Extension Center cooperative agreements, which initially were just for primary care physicians in small and rural practices. So we were excited because we thought, again, boy, rural hospitals, or especially critical access and rural hospitals, I think anybody under 50 beds, which we have, I believe, 22 or 23 of those that qualify, are now eligible for getting some of the assistance. And those folks have a lot of need and a lot of need to not only put in EHRs, but certainly to qualify for some of the financial incentives for having done so. So we are very much starting work with them as well.
This is Paul. We have a federally qualified, an FQHC in Lincoln City. I think the more interesting thing from the FQHC point of view is a different model than ours. It's called OCHIN. And OCHIN is a collaborative across Oregon and Washington. It's basically an application service provider model. And what they've done is they've made the pretty high-tech, high-end electronic health record accessible to small clinics that would basically have no hope of doing it by forming this organization that contracts with small clinics to provide. They use the Epic product, but the product is less important than the process, which is a ASP model that provides, I think they've got about 20 FQHCs in the state. Another advantage to that is it creates a de facto health information exchange because it puts all these independent organizations on the same platform.
Thank you. I want to move to some of the speaker-specific questions. So this question comes in, and Maggie, it's for you. For New Mexico, you listed 4 million patient IDs in your master patient index. Yet there are only 2 million citizens in the state. Are individual patients represented multiple times? If yes, what steps have you taken to get a single representation of the patient in your MPI?
Boy, that's a wonderful question, and that was a confusing two slides there. In our early phase, when we were so grateful for the money from AHRQ, but we frankly had to build a lot of things ourselves and actually learned a lot in that, including a secure messaging system for some of the pilots. But we also had somebody that using some of the the national articles about building a master person index. We had at that time our chief information officer built a preliminary version of a master person index, and it was in that early testing phase that we had 4 million, but they were not unique patients. They were, so we could do the matches and really test how well this initial master person index worked. And one of the interesting things that it did do for us, even though we later went with a commercial product, because when it became time to do the Nationwide Health Information Network, there wasn't time, frankly. You needed to be able to move, be able to deal with major vendors, so we went with the Initiate Master Person Index, which always made me sort of sad because we'd done all this work to develop our own. But what we did learn from it, we could at least use it to look at how much overlap of patients across systems was there. Because remember, the whole idea is if it's going to be useful, health information exchange, there needs to be some, quote, sharing of patients. And that analysis alone, that's where the 4 million, these were not unique patients, but patients over quite a number of years that we were doing matches on, and to see how well we did matches. And we found a very high overlap. A lot of the people at the university and at Press and Lovelace and various systems thought that there wasn't that much overlap, and it turns out there was like 45% overlap. So that work was useful to us, but that's where the confusion lies. This is now, we're now using, when we talk about the 1,330,000, these, the other was just test data that folks were willing to share with us for the building of the Master Person Index and the testing of it. We now are where we actually have formal agreements for sharing the data with us to have real demographic data in our Master Person Index, and that is now 1,330,000 unique patients.
Thank you. The next one is for Dr. Gorman. For the Oregon, the question is, for the Oregon presentation, did you make any use of SureScripts? For instance, did you use PBM data as a data source? It appeared medication reconciliation was done manually. Have you looked at any IT-based solutions?
So that's several questions. First, as to SureScripts, no, we didn't. When we started our project, none of the entities we were dealing with were using SureScripts. Same with RxHub, of course, is a little different. I guess the answer to that is mainly that we were very interested in real-time, what's the prescription supposed to be now, which very often isn't a new prescription, but a change in an existing one. So don't take your Lasix twice a day, take it once. What's the current insulin dose, those kinds of things. And very often they aren't going to be present in any prescription, but they are going to be changes in the actual medication regimen. And so we wanted, what we wanted was the list the patient's supposed to be taking at this moment. At the moment, that's the best version of that is a home health nurse. If you've had a home health nurse go out to the home and interview the patient and look at all their meds, that's golden. Unfortunately, their list goes into their laptop and nowhere else. And one of the more recent changes we've made is to integrate them into our system so we have a current list. But the second part is, what was the second part of that question? SureScripts, RxHub, medication reconciliation.
Right.
Yeah, so yes, an enormous amount of effort. In fact, each of the organizations that we deal with has somebody going over the lists and making sure they're right, at least monthly, nursing home, pharmacy, and so forth. A little different, I think, than capital M, capital R medication reconciliation as performed in the hospital, which has more to do with transitions in care. The patient in the nursing home isn't going anywhere necessarily, but there's a monthly process of making sure all their treatments are correct. We've actually not found any tools that assist medication reconciliation, and so we've been working for the last couple of years to develop some. Just a couple of the problems. First of all, the meds have to be normalized, so that a representation in one list, say lisinopril, and a representation in another list also saying lisinopril, there's no way for the computer to know those are the same thing. And so they have to be normalized to a standard like RxNorm. There's also no standard classification so that no two systems would know that lisinopril in one system and enalapril in another system are in the same class. There's no standard for that. So we've been working to connect the identity of medicine to a class using NDFRT, the VA system, or ATC, the World Health Organization system for medication classification. And we think if we're able to get these tools running, then we can assist the nurse or the doctor or the pharmacist who's looking at the list to help them find things that are duplicates and within class duplication and so forth. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. And, of course, you know, if any of the questions are not answered, you can feel free to send in another question under the Q&A tab. Let's get in just a few more here. So one of the questions that came in that I would actually like to just sort of throw in an AHRQ piece to it, there's a question that came in. We are a very small primary care health clinic located in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans and currently use paper charts and would like to move to an EHR. What advice can you give and resources could you recommend before we purchase an EMR? Is there anyone we can call for assistance in this area? And one of the things that I just wanted to point out from AHRQ is, again, on our website, healthit.ahrq.gov, on the left-hand side, we do have a tab called Health IT Tools, and that could serve as a potential resource depending on where you are at in your purchasing phase. We do have a Health IT Adoption Toolbox, and so I just wanted to point that out and direct folks there for various resources. But if the panelists have any other resources that they'd like to, state, please do so.
Oh, I definitely do in New Mexico because we're heading just the kind of organization that's all around that is virtually 98% of the United States now has a starting regional extension center that is exactly for that purpose, to reach out and provide as much help as possible, everything from trying to help you find sources of loans to looking at, they've done a lot. We did here a request for information questionnaire for vendors so we could find the most viable vendors for primary care and so that we could also help people find even financing modalities and so on to help them. And then also, frankly, the IT and workflow kinds of work that you need. How do you, that most small practices just don't know, and it's intended to take you from paper, if that's where you are, or if you're a little further along, all the way to, quote, meaningful use, which has, or I presume that organization would have, for example, a large Medicaid component. It is very likely that, therefore, you can qualify for up to $63,000 over a number of years of Medicaid help, and I think if you could get in touch with your local regional extension center, I would think there's something called state health IT coordinators, usually in the state government. You should be able to find something. There probably is a website for your area or for your state that would help you find these health IT regional extension centers. They are funded by the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. That's part of HHS, so you could find them that way too. And I really think that's exactly what these folks are really, frankly, they're being paid to help you. And
absolutely. That's the whole point of them, to solve that problem.
So I think that it's you just don't want to miss that opportunity.
Yeah, I would concur. In the state of Pennsylvania, it's the same way, but I know it's across all 50 states. So please look into that. Maggie eloquently stated all the functions that they're going to provide. It was excellent.
Thank you. It's now 1:30. I'm going to get in a few more questions, but if folks need to drop off, that's fine. We just have a few more. So one of the questions, I'm not sure who it may be directed to, it says telemedicine for rural psychiatric adolescent facilities. Do you have data regarding this clientele and outcomes?
This is John. I can talk a little bit. We don't have it for adolescents. We are starting a telepsych program, and we are starting to collect information. Ours is really focused on the veterans post-traumatic war syndrome. It was a different initiative, and we are using two-way video conferencing out to rural settings through these high bandwidth connections, and having our psychiatry and psychology department supporting that. from the organization here in Danville. However, we do have outcomes, some outcomes on that, but it is not toward the adolescent population.
And I would, this is Paul. There was a systematic review conducted for the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality on consumer health IT applications, and some of the applications they looked at were basically consumer access to mental health services using a variety of versions of technology, and so there might be an answer or partial answer in that report, an ARC systematic review published about 2 years ago.
And in New Mexico, we have something funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, that's called SBIRT, S-B-I-R-T, and it's about using telemedicine for screening and brief intervention and referral for treatment. It's very much about behavioral health, substance abuse, those kinds of systems. In fact, I just talked to him today. Dr. Arturo Gonzalez here was the head of that. So Mike, perhaps, I don't, maybe if somebody is interested, we could get you in touch. I think they did do. I'm quite sure they had some good outcomes. I just don't have them at my immediate disposal. But if you wanted to contact me, I would get you in touch with Dr. Gonzalez, or it may be that through SAMHSA, their websites, you could find some of that information as well.
Thank you for some of those federal resources. Along those lines, one of the questions that came in, our folks noticed that you mentioned our RECs, Regional Extension Centers. Is there an established REC for Northern California? What about LECs? The panelists can feel free to answer this question if they have the answer. Otherwise, I would suggest folks going to HHS.gov. This is where you can link on to the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT site, and there should be a listing there of regional extension centers.
Yes, and this is Paul. For California, the California Healthcare Foundation would know. I'm involved with a project with the California Healthcare Foundation to implement electronic health records in rural practices, not in Northern California, but CHCF would definitely know who the REC is for the state or for that part of California. And HHS should have all that.
That's right, and it should be up on their web by now. Okay, last two questions. So which HIS vendors have you had to integrate with? Were there problems encountered? And were these exchanges of data seamless to the hospital-based end users? And I think that's for all three panelists.
Seamless?
Nothing seems to be seamless.
There is no seamless.
This is John. I could talk about different vendors that we've integrated with, and I would reiterate exactly what all the other panelists have stated. It is not anywhere near seamless. What we are doing at this point, we are not at CCD integration, so we are doing a lot of HL7, ADT, and results, ORU results, and things like that. But vendors we've worked with, Cerner, Epic is the vendor that we utilize, Famous, which is now GE Centricity. We've integrated to a lot of those, but basically they've been Health Language 7 integration points at this point in time, and that pretty much standardized the process as much as possible. There are always some tweaks and changes, though, of course.
And I have to say that the cost of interfaces is something that, as a country, we're really going to have to deal, because you might think, let's say, that if you have an Epic system and somebody else has an Epic system, that they're going to talk to each other, and that is not necessarily the case. The same with Cerner and others. So I think that it's broader than a few particular vendors. I think it's really...
It's system-wide.
Isn't it? It absolutely
is. It's system-wide. We have some practices that aren't really reaping the benefits that they could from their EHRs because they can't afford the connection to the local hospital or lab. I guess the we've dealt with a lot of vendors that the kind of bottom line, I think, is that it's not a purchase, it's a marriage. That's the way to think about a relationship with a vendor. Whoever it is that you go with, you're going to be living with that organization for a long time. And that's probably as important as the technology is the relationship that they have with you and how supportive and so forth.
And quite frankly, we are working with several other states in the West to say, okay, if we're not powerful enough by ourselves, can we really negotiate as a number of states with vendors so that there would be a standard interface that everybody used, because I think as a country we really, it's so important for us to link with one another, and it is so expensive. So that's why in that sense the technology is not there yet, and the interoperability is clearly not there yet. As you say, HL7, people are at all different levels of that. They are even creating, we talk about exchanging a summary patient record or CCD. Turns out that is much more complicated than most of us thought it would be. And so I think those are the lessons that those of us in the trenches are learning.
I would agree with Maggie 200%. What we're seeing going toward the CCDs or the continuity care documents is that vendors write to an IEG standard. Typically, you go to the HIMSS showcase, they'll have interoperability showcases. Even though it's a standard, what we've been seeing and upwards of $100,000 of consulting time involved from the vendor's perspective in order to make a CCD function properly. So at this point in time, very costly, very arduous process, and it's just one that's going to take a lot of patience and just some time to work through.
Thank you.
This is, we don't mean to discourage you. I said in my lessons learned, innovation is messy, but I think it is so worth it. And we've got to, it's really, this is a critical part of healthcare transformation. And it's just going to take us some resilience and patience. And the other problem is it unfortunately takes substantial funding.
I think patience may help us get there. Not the kind spelled with a T. I just had a young man who was going home from the hospital and wanted us to put his record on his USB drive. You know, so he could take it back to his doctor in a rural area. And I think it may well be that patient demand for access to this information, electronic form, will help us move in the direction of interoperability.
I agree. We just had a radio interview this morning with a Santa Fe station, and one of the things we said too is that patients themselves, that's ENTS, can really be a mover in this. I think patients, while they care about privacy for sure, they also care about not giving having good care, not giving the same information 300 times to different folks, not having elderly caregivers that can never get information across their specialists and the long-term care facility and so on. So I think we do need to mobilize consumers in this in the most positive way so that they know the benefits, they know the protections, and they can help us move the system.
Thank you. These are good questions, good discussions. And I just want to mention AHRQ funds, numerous grants that engage with various vendors. And, of course, we do not endorse any one system. Last question, which is sort of an opinion question for the panel. Do you think it's possible to successfully implement a rural HIE in the absence of cutting-edge health systems such as those that were presented today?
Yes.
I would agree.
In fact, it might be easier. We had one of the communities in Oregon, in eastern Oregon, Burns. It occurred to them long before it occurred to anyone in the rest of the state that they could have a county-wide sharing of data electronically. And I think in some ways a smaller community without big national players to deal with is more nimble and can make these decisions and move on them more readily if they have the technical support accessible to them.
I think you're right. I think we have a really nifty a group that's really put together an HIE in Silver City, which is a small town in southern New Mexico, but they just have the sharpest people at this Gila Regional Medical Center. And I think you're right. Now, what you do want to have happen, whether it's the university doing their own or a small, what you don't want to do is waste resources. Like, for example, if we're coming around with the state HIE and can help you with federal dollars, then we want all that innovation, but we want it to be, again, try to link it to other folks around the state and across states that are doing the same kind of work. You just, again, want to know what's going on in your state so that you can really take advantage of these great places that are doing some real rural innovation, and I think you're exactly right that sometimes there they can get it done when big cities and all their fighting can't.
Yeah, I've seen that. This is John. I would agree. Seen in the state of New York where they have a number of HIEs and some potentially contentious situations. If you're in a rural setting, I think there are immense opportunities. And the key, I believe, personally, is collaboration, defining exactly what your goals are and trying to build collaboration with other healthcare organizations and physicians in the community. I think all too often people are concerned that information will be used against them from a health information exchange. And we have in our bylaws stated that it is for patient treatment purposes only. It is not for payment or operation. So
we do the same.
Yeah, and I think, Maggie, I think that's really important, and I think it's important that everyone understands this is all about the patient. It's not about a healthcare system. It is not about, you know, any one particular healthcare system. It's improving the care of your community, and it's providing access to information that can help substantiate that and support it.
But one last comment, despite what we just said, as a healthcare researcher and somebody who cares about public health, someday I do hope that in a privacy-protected way that this data could be, there are so many holes in our understanding in a given state or across the United States. For epidemiologists and others that want to understand where the gaps in healthcare are, that someday this kind of information, when we work through these issues, will be enormously valuable in an aggregate format, but not to be used for anything other than I think, quality improvement. So I think those are the things we can look for, I think, in the future, speaking of an AHRQ emphasis, quality and research emphasis.
Well, thank you. This now concludes our national teleconference. I want to thank Maggie, Paul, and John for great presentations and a great Q&A session. Also, thank you to the audience for joining us. The last slide we have is until the AHRQ has their next national teleconference. We just wanted to feature the next HRSA teleconference, Meaningful Use 3 Grantee Tips for Implementation. That will be held September 17th, 2 to 3:30, and registration information about that event will be forthcoming. So thank you, and this concludes the national teleconference.
Thank you.